This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. For 6 years, Lawrence Walsh was responsible for investigating the Iran-Contra affair and for prosecuting the crimes committed by the people behind it. His final report was released in January of 1994. Now in his early 80s, Walsh has written a memoir describing what happened behind the scenes of the investigation. He titled his memoir, Firewall, because he says Ronald Reagan was protected from disgrace and possible impeachment by the firewall his advisors erected around him. The Iran-Contra affair dates back to the mid-80s, when the Reagan administration illegally funneled support to the Contras, a paramilitary group fighting against the Sandinista Revolution in Nicaragua. The administration also violated its own policy of not negotiating with terrorists. It sold arms to Iran in exchange for the release of hostages. The profits from the arms sales were diverted to the Contras. Walsh wasn't able to get many of the convictions he wanted. I asked him the result he most wishes he'd achieved.
Well, I guess the full disclosure of the truth would be highest. And that would mean proving the responsibility of the highest officers who were responsible for the acts that were unlawful. And if, in certain cases, to have prosecuted them. I guess if I were going to pick an example, Attorney General Meese, in my judgment, formulated the false position of the administration denying certain arms sales through the Israelis. Even though he knew the president had known about them and had authorized them, and even though all of the president's top foreign policy advisors knew that, they all sat silent while Meese told them the president didn't know, and if he did know, it could be unlawful. Now, we didn't get this information. We didn't get Weinberger's notes, which carried this almost word for word, or Donald Regan's notes, which carried it word for word, until 5 years after the investigation started. And at that point, I didn't think we could effectively prosecute Meese.
What are some of the things you believe but you couldn't prove about the people at the top, former President Reagan, former President Bush?
Well, my impression was that President Reagan knew the substance of what was going on. He might not have been told in detail, but he knew that the arms sales were funding the Contras, in my judgment. And we were never able to prove that because Admiral Poindexter, who was the person who from whom he would have learned it, always said that he didn't have to tell that to the president because the president, he knew the president would have approved it if he had told him, and he wanted to preserve his deniability. Yet when Poindexter went to trial, Poindexter's lawyer told the judge that the president knew everything that Poindexter had done. And that in reciting these things, it included the diversion of funds from the Iranian arms sales to the support of the Contras. So that is what my impression was, and that's what the status of the proof was.
What about George Bush? What do you believe that he knew but that you couldn't prove?
I think Bush knew quite a lot. He's always denied that he knew about the diversion of funds, and no one has ever testified that he did in fact know about it. But he had been a former director of the CIA, and he was privy to all of the president's morning intelligence briefings when he was in town. And Poindexter said that as far as the arms sales were concerned, the Iranian arms sales were concerned, if Bush missed a meeting, he would personally go and brief Bush. And in fact, when those sales were threatened with being broken off, when he was in Israel, he received a briefing on the arms sales and then came back and briefed the president, and the sales were resumed. So he was not a stranger to the transaction.
One of the things that seems to have made you angriest was former Secretary of Defense Caspar Weinberger lying about having notes. He took notes on the meetings. Yeah. He told you he didn't. That seems to have gotten to you perhaps more than a lot of the other things that got to you.
Well, just look at what happened. We started our investigation, really, the beginning of 1987. We got his notes in 1992. 5 years had been lost. If we'd had his notes at the beginning, believe me, the proof would have been marshaled very quickly. And the problem of when the statute of limitations running or second people's recollections fading over 5 years would have been eliminated. And finally, I just think it's wrong for the Secretary of Defense was right in the center of this. The Hawk missiles that were shipped through Israel, they had to come from him. He had to be the person who would replace the Hawks for the Israelis so that the Israeli arsenal wasn't depleted. So this wasn't something in which Weinberger was a bystander. He was the critical cabinet officer. And for him to lie to Congress about the substance of the facts and then to sit as he did when they took his deposition, he sat looking at his great big desk, which was full of his notepads. And as he, even while he was looking at it, he said he didn't keep notes, that he only kept a few, and that they had gone through the filing system of the department, whereas he was keeping his personal notes in his own office.
You were also pretty angry at George Bush for pardoning Caspar Weinberger shortly before George Bush left office. It was Christmas Eve, was it?
Christmas Eve. Yeah, that was perhaps the most disgraceful single act. That was worse. And what President Reagan did, whether it was right or wrong, lawful or unlawful, he really did think he was acting in the interest of the country. George Bush was acting in his own interest. He was trying to cut off the Weinberger trial because he knew the trial would expose publicly the participation not only of Weinberger, but of those with whom Weinberger was associated, including George Bush, who was at the meeting when the false position was laid out.
Did you ever consider subpoenaing George Bush?
Yes, I did. That was about the last thing. After Bush pardoned Weinberger, and he was still holding out his own notes. He'd given us some prior to the pardon, only a few a week or two prior to the pardon. And then we still had more to come. And we had delayed his final interrogation until after the campaign was over because we did not really want to intrude in the campaign, although he always thought we deliberately did. But then when we came to question him, he wanted to limit his questions to his notes and not be questioned generally about his knowledge of Iran-Contra. And I thought that would be a charade, and I wanted to subpoena him before the grand jury. At this point, my staff was unanimous against me. They felt that it would look like I was retaliating for the pardon, which, of course, I wasn't trying to do, really. And second, that we did not have a sufficient probability that a crime would be proven to draw the grand jury into it and start grand jury interrogations. And third, that the public would misunderstand our activity and have an exaggerated anticipation of what was going to come out when the odds were that we would not indict Bush.
Early on, one of the things that really worked against your investigation was the congressional hearings into the Iran-Contra affair. And the biggest problem there, I think, was the granting of immunity to key figures like Oliver North and John Poindexter. They got immunity so that they could speak and tell everything they knew, or hopefully tell everything they knew, without getting prosecuted themselves. The sacrifice was, okay, we won't be able to prosecute them, but at least the truth will emerge. How did that work against your investigation?
Well, it hurt very severely, and it caused the reversal of the convictions of North and Poindexter. The jury convicted both of felonies, and Poindexter was actually sentenced to prison. But because of the immunity granted by Congress, the Court of Appeals reversed the convictions. The Immunity is an exchange for waiving a privilege against self-incrimination. No person has to testify and incriminate himself because of the constitutional protection. But if Congress or the prosecutor give him immunity that prevents the use of his testimony against him, he may be forced to testify. Now, Congress did that, but the immunity is worded as though it were just protecting against the use of the testimony he gives. But the courts have construed that to protect him from any prosecution developed by facts which were led to by the testimony he gave. So it's a very dangerous area for a prosecutor to have to deal with.
You were in a very strange position during the hearings because you and your staff were not allowed to hear any of the testimony by witnesses who were given immunity, Poindexter and North. And those were crucial people to your investigation, and what they were saying was crucial to your investigation. Why weren't you allowed to hear any of their immunized testimony?
Well, if we'd heard their immunized testimony, they would claim we were using it against them. Mm-hmm. And that's prohibited under the Constitution. But it was very ironic that the witnesses we were questioning had heard it, and they also knew we had not heard it. So they were better prepared in a sense than we were, whereas a prosecutor always likes to be better prepared than the witness he's questioning.
Lawrence Walsh is my guest. He was the independent counsel in the Iran-Contra investigation. He's written a new book about the investigation now called Firewall. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Lawrence Walsh, the independent counsel in the Iran-Contra investigation. His new book is called Firewall, the Iran-Contra Conspiracy and Cover-Up. Now, we were talking about the immunity and how that hurt your investigation. Something else that hurt your investigation was the national security community's power to, as you put it, over-classify information to prevent the full exposure of its misconduct. What are some examples of documents that shouldn't have been classified, in your opinion, but were?
All right. The most obvious one I can think of. McFarlane, National Security Council and the White House generally had an interior communication system, and in which they could tape messages back and forth to each other. These were called prof notes, P-R-O-F notes. And in one, Weinberger, after the scandal was breaking, sent one to North, "I hope to blazes that somebody has sanitized the files of the National Security Agency." And that's all it said. And the Council for the National Security Agency insisted that that be classified and tried to keep it from going in the trial. We didn't need that so much, but North wanted it in his defense. And even after the case, it was three-quarters way through the trial, she went to Attorney General Thornburg to get him to block the trial to keep that note out. Now, that just showed an exaggerated concern of one agency to protect its own skirts. There's nothing in there that was going to hurt the country, nothing in there that was telling anybody anything they didn't already know, but it was just an effort to keep the agency from being exposed as having participated in with North and his activities. And they had assisted North in both arms of his activities, both in by furnishing him with super secret communication gear for in his work supplying the Contras, and also in his work in getting the arms delivered to Iran in the hope the hostages would be released.
So you think that the CIA overclassified a lot of documents relevant to the investigation just to cover its own tracks?
I can't see it. You know, let me be fair. Their argument is the CIA is different from the National Security Agency. There was no justification whatever for what the National Security Agency did. But the CIA has people posted throughout the world, and they are there by grace of the host country. And the CIA is always concerned that if they disclose something that happened in one host country, that the other hosts may close down on their facilities in the other countries. So they are always arguing for deniability, that even though the facts are known, a government agency, a United States government agency, must not confirm them. So that was their argument. Now, in one case, we had an indictment in, and were trying to try, and then had to give up, was a man named Fernandez, who was the CIA station chief in Costa Rica. He claimed that he had to disclose the existence of certain bases in Central American countries. Now, these were publicly known. Everyone knew. One had even been burned down by the right-left wingers, so that if our enemies knew it, at least our court might know it. And CIA refused to confirm this. They went as far as they could without doing that. But the judge said this had to come out, and he had to be free to discuss it, or he was going to dismiss the case, and he finally dismissed the case, and the Court of Appeals affirmed it.
William Casey, the former head of the CIA, died during the Iran-Contra investigation. What had you hoped that he would reveal?
Well, assuming he would tell the truth, he could have revealed the central machinery. Next to President Reagan, he was probably the best informed of what was going on. And he was better informed than President Reagan, as much as I think he knew the details, whereas the president only knew in a general way what was happening. So Casey would have been very helpful if he would tell the truth, but he was notoriously able, a very skilled person, and he would have tried to, I'm sure, bamboozle us the same as he did Congress at times, and got Congress quite angry, and that was one of the reasons they shut off aid to the Contras. But I would, I think that Casey would have ended up either as a defendant or a very key witness.
What tools do you feel you needed that you didn't have?
It wasn't so much a matter of tools. What we needed was lack of interference by Congress, lack of interference by strong political leaders who were trying to protect the president and his cabinet. The tool that would have helped most, though, is some way of dealing with this problem of classification of documents.
The paradox of your position when you were independent counsel is that you were picked by the administration, and then you were prosecuting the administration. You were a lifelong Republican, an admirer President Reagan's. Do you ever think that maybe you were picked because they thought you'd be a team player?
No. I think the judges who picked me knew me personally, and they knew that wouldn't make any difference. But it was a true. They knew certainly that I wasn't going to try to embarrass President Reagan or any other Republican just for political purposes.
Mm-hmm. Are you still a Republican?
Yes, I stayed that way. My father was one, and all my family has been Republicans, and I just haven't cut the last thread, but there have been times during the last 7 years when I've been tempted. And I must say I voted for Clinton twice.
Oh, did you? I'm wondering,
Robert Dole was one of my worst critics and most unreasonable persons, and I said you couldn't vote for him. Nor did I feel I could vote for
George Bush.
Yeah.
Right. I'm wondering if you feel that late in life you were forced into becoming more cynical about politics after you'd seen people lie to your face and cover up, people at the very top.
I'd been in Washington before, so cynicism didn't come to me as a shock. I realized that there's a lot of it there. I was shocked that a majority leader of a Republican leader of the Senate would intrude in a criminal case politicians, really, you know, senior politicians, keep out of criminal prosecutions. They don't try to fix a criminal prosecution. Whereas Dole just was unabashed in his effort to destroy the case against Weinberger, making strong public pronouncements against us, calling us hired assassins. And he continued this right up until the jury had been called in, had been notified that they were going to try the case. The case was set for trial in early January 1993. Jury was notified to appear, and Dole was still pounding us. And who do you think also turned on us? But the Attorney General of the Bush administration. The Attorney General was saying that we were getting indictments that we shouldn't have gotten. So it was just an administration, particularly after Bush's defeat, they were just running loose. Maybe there was some feeling, I think, that that we'd had to clarify an indictment just before the election day, not through any choice of ours. And somehow, I think that looking around for someone to blame for his defeat, President Bush had picked me, and some of his administration felt that way.
Lawrence Walsh was the independent counsel in the Iran-Contra investigation. His new memoir is called Firewall. He'll be back with us in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Lawrence Walsh, the independent counsel in the Iran-Contra investigation. He's written a new memoir about the investigation called Firewall. In your memoir, you say that when it comes to an investigation, you think that the president should basically be cut some slack, that you shouldn't be too overzealous in pursuing the president because the president is in office. So what were your guidelines about that?
Well, I believe that he should have every courtesy. The president is the one person in the country who is on duty 24 hours a day, every day. He never has any time off. He never has any period for second guessing. He's always subject to some emergency. So when a prosecutor comes along and starts looking at this and looking at that, the president, it seems to me, should be protected as much as possible. I never questioned President Reagan until 5 years after I started. I needed his testimony to make sure he hadn't authorized North, make sure he didn't admit authorizing North or Poindexter to do what they did so they could claim they were acting for him. And so I did that by written interrogatories, which we served on him, and then his lawyer could help him answer it. When I finally did get his face-to-face testimony, it was much later, after I had gotten everything I could from everyone else, and he was really the last person I questioned. I think it's something not just out of consideration for the individual, but it's important consideration for the country that the president not be unduly distracted by these things.
What do you think is the larger significance of the crimes that were committed in the Iran-Contra story?
The crimes were significant because they attack the basic structure of the Constitution. Congress has the power to control appropriations and control the use of government funds. Congress has the power of oversight over the executive. The executive has very broad powers, but Congress has a right to know what he has done and what he is doing. And the basic element of the crime that pulls these sort of three interlocked conspiracies together was an effort to deceive Congress on such a basic and important matter that it was depriving it of both control over appropriations and control over oversight. So that was the nature of the crime that I think that makes it so important.
How would you compare the Iran-Contra story with the Watergate story in terms of the magnitude of the crime?
In terms of the constitutional importance of the crime, Iran-Contra is the more important. In terms of the personal drama of the involvement of the presidency, Watergate was more shocking because in Watergate, the president was actually corrupting the are trying to corrupt the flow of evidence into the courts. And I think money was being used in that way. And it was, it sort of had a venal purpose. It did not have any purpose of serving the country. In Iran-Contra, although it was constitutionally much more important, President Reagan didn't think for a minute he wasn't serving the country. He thought he was doing what he did, not for any personal gain, but because it was important to the protection of the government, country from a government, from a communist threat in Central America, and because for humane purposes he had an obligation as president to get those hostages free. So he had a high-minded but willful purpose. The other had a venal and not so attractive, and then not a public interest purpose.
The Watergate story ends very dramatically. President Nixon resigns and leaves Washington disgraced. Right. Did you wish for an ending that dramatic to the Iran-Contra story?
No, Frank. Although I was investigating and as hard as I could for 5 years, I never stopped liking President Reagan. I would not have gotten any joy out of seeing him forced to resign or even be disgraced after he left office. I simply, as a matter of thoroughness, felt that it was wrong to let subordinates suffer for something which a president oversaw. And therefore, there was a duty not to stop with the subordinates if there was evidence pointing above it. The evidence never accumulated to that point that it would have been justified to prosecute the president.
In the introduction to your new memoir, you ask yourself if, despite the many defeats, did you ultimately win? And if you won, was it the war you thought you were fighting or one quite different? So let me ask you those questions. Despite the defeats, do you think you won, and did you win something different than what you thought you were trying to win?
Yeah, I think we won in the sense that we have established, I think with certainty, that career officers who try to support and cover up a willful president do so at their own jeopardy, that they are going to end up the losers. The president will escape, probably, but they'll be convicted of crime. I think that was the big lesson. Secondarily, if, in fact, Bush were correct, that our investigation or anything we did was responsible for his defeat, I think we did clean the government from a cover-up administration. I think the Bush administration was a cover-up administration. They were hostile to the prosecution of their political associates, even though their guilt was obvious. So those are two ways of looking at it.
Judge Walsh, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, it's been a pleasure.
Lawrence Walsh was the independent counsel in the Iran-Contra investigation. His new memoir is called Firewall.